And welcome to a new week of Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We have a lot on the agenda today.
Sure do.
Later this segment, we're going to be talking about South Jersey political juggernaut George Norcross. He was indicted on Monday and now faces a slew of federal charges. He's accused of running a racketeering scheme implicating a number of other individuals, including former Camden Mayor Dana Redd. We're going to talk to WNYC reporter Nancy Solomon, who's covered Camden, who's covered New Jersey politics for quite a while. And we'll be talking about that. Also, the big topic for today is school vouchers, something I'm sure you know a lot about, Avi, as a former education reporter.
I know a little. Let's not set the bar too high. Yeah. We're going to learn a lot about vouchers today. There is a big proposal in front of the Pennsylvania legislature. Jay-Z has waded into this debate, kind of out of left field. So we're going to talk with some experts about vouchers. We're going to hear from a couple parents, and we would love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-WHYY. That's 9499. Give us a call if you have opinions about school vouchers. You can also email us, studio2@whyy.org.
And people have thoughts. They're already coming
we
in.
We got a lot of thoughts coming
Facebook.
In.
Yeah.
This is certainly a hot topic. By the way, Cherry, Hearst Potato Chips doing its annual new flavor competition.
Uh-oh.
The choices this year are pierogi flavored. Ravioli flavored.
That sounds like it might be good.
And stromboli flavored.
Ooh, stromboli.
Is that the one for you?
I'm thinking the ravioli one. Yeah, that sounds like it might be good. But, you know, you can never tell. Last time I liked the pork, roast pork
That's
one.
Right. That's right.
I didn't think I would like it.
Came out,
because you got to counter
and smell
taste it first. And all I'm that
just,
kind of
I'm
stuff.
I'm just going for a first impression. Okay, you think ravioli.
What about you?
I think stromboli is going to be the strongest one this year, but I am waiting to try all three. You probably don't want to eat too much salty stuff right now because it's going to be very hot today. And for the rest of the week, we have a heat wave that has descended on the region, and it will peak probably Friday, Saturday, Sunday in that range. Looking at temperatures in the mid to upper 90s, just want to make sure folks have the resources they need if you're looking for a place to stay cool or you want information about the weather. Over in New Jersey, check out heathub.nj. If you're looking for places in Philly to cool off, check out our resources at whyy.org. We've got a lot of stuff compiled there. Look, the heat can be very dangerous. It's one of the most dangerous types of extreme weather. So make sure you stay cool. Make sure you stay hydrated.
Yeah, drink lots of water and use your sunscreen. We talked about that a couple
weeks ago. Yes, use your
Protect
sunscreen.
Protect the skin. So going down to Delaware, looks like Delaware congressional candidate Sarah McBride will likely be the Democratic nominee. And if she wins in November, she could become the first openly transgender person in the U.S. Congress. Her main challenger for the Democratic nomination is former State Housing Authority Director Eugene Young, who suspended his campaign for the U.S. House of Representatives last week. This all but guarantees that Sarah McBride will be the pick in this very blue state. And McBride would run against Republican challenger Danielle Hall, who is a veteran, Dover resident, and small business owner, also identifies as biracial. But, you know, Sarah McBride has secured some really high-profile endorsements.
Yeah, she's
Nancy
the party pick.
Pelosi.
There's no doubt about that.
Former Speaker of the House. You know, we also have Lisa Blunt Rochester, the congresswoman from Delaware, who's now running for the U.S. Senate, endorsed her as well. So she's very likely the person from Delaware.
Yeah, very blue state, like you mentioned. If people don't know, Delaware only has
one
congressional representative.
Seat, yes.
So this is a statewide race. Look, it's not totally out of the question that she could lose in November. I believe Blunt Rochester got about 55% in the last election. So it's not, you know, it's not 60, it's not 70. But very likely, Sarah McBride is going to be the Democratic nominee and then is going to be a congressperson for the state of Delaware, the first openly transgender person to serve in either the House or Senate. She's already the highest ranking elected member of any state legislature.
Yeah.
She's a state senator right now in Delaware. So some history potentially going to be made in November.
Yeah, looking forward to watching that. And they have their they have their primary in September, which is a little
very
different.
Late primary. Yeah. So Delaware's got a lot of weird stuff going on with the electoral system. Yeah, they do the primary very, very late. So we won't know for sure if she's the Democratic nominee for a couple months, but it looks very, very likely at this point. For a long time, you could count on a relationship between the Rothman Institute and the Philadelphia Eagles.
Not anymore.
You spoiled it.
Sorry.
For decades, they were the official team physician for the Birds, but they're dropping that relationship because of a very large medical malpractice verdict that was issued against them related to a procedure that they did on a former Eagles player named Chris Maragos. That's interesting.
Yeah.
That they see that liability as too costly for them to continue in this, like I said, decades-long relationship with the Philadelphia Eagles, a relationship that brings them a lot of attention and presumably business. But what's more interesting, I think, is the backstory behind this.
Yeah.
Which is that there was a rule change that has allowed many, many more people to file medical malpractice lawsuits in the city of Philadelphia, where the reputation is that the juries are more favorable to the plaintiffs. So there's been this huge spike in medical malpractice suits here in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And anyways, Harold Brubaker had a story at the Inquirer all about this, and we just thought it was interesting because this is a trend that I was not aware of.
Yeah, well, I know a lot of lawyers, and this is a very favorable Philadelphia, very favorable venue for these types of lawsuits. And under the rule, you can file a case in Philadelphia rather than in the county where an incident occurred if the defendant has a business presence in the city.
At all.
Yeah, even if the incident occurred
someplace
else.
They botched the surgery in Montana. Yeah. You have an office in Philly. They can take the case before a Philadelphia jury.
Yeah, and according to Rothman, which was interesting, I mean, they already pay $100,000 a year per physician per year for insurance.
Yeah.
And so the only other option they had was to up their insurance even more, but it's so cost prohibitive that they've decided to pull out. And so I wonder what type of, impact this rule will have on other businesses. People just don't want to be sued.
Maybe just don't have that office in Philadelphia. Yeah. Put it over
put
City
it
Line
else.
Avenue.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I just hadn't heard much about this. And the Inquirer has run the numbers, and it's a massive spike since this rule passed. So clearly lawyers, like you said,
see
Philadelphia as a favorable venue. And now that this loophole has opened up, maybe I shouldn't call it a loophole, this opening has presented itself. Many, many lawyers are clearly taking advantage of it because I don't think there was a sudden spike in actual medical malpractice in Philadelphia.
Yeah, for sure. And so, some Philly lawyers are probably happy, though. They get more lawsuits to file. Mm-hmm. So moving on to our newsmaker, New Jersey kingmaker and insurance executive George Norcross was charged with racketeering in a 13-count indictment that was unveiled by New Jersey Attorney General Matt Plackin yesterday. Norcross is accused of running a criminal enterprise using coercion, extortion, and other criminal acts to obtain property rights and tax breaks in the redevelopment of the Camden waterfront.
His brother, Philip Norcross, along with his lawyer, William Tambusi, and former Camden mayor, Dana Redd, are also charged in this case. Joining us to walk through this indictment, it's 111 pages, so we really need to walk through a lot of it here, is WNYC reporter Nancy Solomon, who has covered this issue inside and out for years and done a lot of reporting on the redevelopment of the Camden waterfront. Nancy, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And so, Nancy, you heard it, 111-page criminal indictment centered around political juggernaut George Norcross. Can you lay out the basic allegations and charges against him?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned racketeering, and I think that's the key thing for people to understand is that the New Jersey State Attorney General, Matt Plotkin, has put together what's, called a RICO case. And, those are the laws that were passed in the 1960s to basically take down the mob. And now, it basically defines, if a prosecutor can define something as a criminal enterprise, then that kicks in, a much larger, more flexible ability to come up with criminal charges because, it is an enterprise that uses many different elements to benefit the leaders of that enterprise. So in the case of George Norcross, he's known as the party boss of South Jersey, and that's often said about him, although it's hard to really for folks to get wrap their heads around what that means exactly. But what the indictment alleges is that he and his brother Phil led a scheme that involved gaining fraudulent tax breaks from the state of New Jersey worth really literally hundreds of millions of dollars to redevelop the Camden waterfront. Folks in Philadelphia, when you look across, you now see the Norcross Tower. You know, that's a free building. He was able to build that with his two business partners who were also indicted with state tax breaks. And the whole idea of the state tax break program was you have, you know, a business would have to demonstrate to the state, look, we're going to leave the state or we're going to move into the state. If you give us a tax break, we need that incentive or we're not coming. And that basically the criminal charges are that they lied about the fact that they would leave the state because they were really just down the road in the suburbs in in Marlton, just outside of Camden. Wow. So,
and Nancy,
so that's one element.
And can I ask you also about this? There was stuff in the indictment about maybe intimidating other developers or using kind of rough tactics. Can you walk us through that part?
Yeah, this is really fascinating stuff. And it involves a Philadelphia developer who's very well known, Carl Dranoff. Mm-hmm. Carl Dranoff was basically lobbied and invited and cajoled and begged to come to Camden, I believe in the 90s or the early aughts, and invest in the Camden waterfront. Dranoff rehabbed an old RCA building and turned it into luxury lofts. And it was one of the only things, you know, real development items that was going on the waterfront for many years. Basically, it's complicated, but Dranoff had a view easement, which is basically the right to maintain the view of his from his building, from those
to
apartments,
the water.
Across to the water and to the skyline of Philadelphia, which is really breathtaking from that spot. I mean, you have a gorgeous view of Philadelphia from the Camden waterfront. And that was his right, was to keep that view. And that was something he negotiated and got. The Norcross and his two business partners, they wanted to build that tower, which blocks the view. And they basically strong-armed him. And I'm not going to get the quote. I don't have it in front of me. I'm not going to get it. Maybe I do have it in front of me, not exactly right, and I will clean it up for our listeners. But basically, Norcross said to Dranoff, you know, if you F this up, I'll F you up like you've never been F'd up before. I'll make sure you never do business in this town again.
Well, that does sound like a mob boss type of sentence.
And so, Nancy, for folks who do not know New Jersey politics, I want you to kind of explain to folks who George Norcross is and how, you know, such as a figure such that even, you know, allegations like this could even be plausible. Explain who he is in South Jersey politics or in Jersey politics.
Right. So he was born in Camden. His father was a very well-known and well-respected labor leader in Camden County, you know, real dyed-in-the-wool working class Democrat family. He got his start in politics when he was college aged, raising money for local candidates in Camden. And he basically worked his way up the political chain. He was never a candidate. I think the only government office he ever held was as chairman of the Camden Parking Authority.
Which never elected to anything, which is sort of mind-blowing for folks who don't understand this dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Although, you know, when you work at run the Camden Parking Authority, you get a pretty good view into how to use patronage jobs to build a machine. But at any rate, so he built a political machine that was very good at getting people elected. You know, ran like real professional campaigns and put money into those campaigns. And he created, I mean, this is machine politics that's classic. It's a virtuous cycle, if you can use the word virtuous in this context, I'm not sure. But basically, you know, he put money into campaigns. Those people got elected. They did favors for him. And he held people's feet to the fire to create a coalition which built more power. So you get, say, in the legislature for a while there, he had the largest group block of votes. He got Steve Sweeney, his childhood friend, elected to be the state Senate president, which is a, one of the most powerful positions in the state. He built an alliance with Chris Christie, who, Republican governor, makes a deal with Democratic Party boss. And so you're able to amass political power behind the scenes, and he was able to amass political power behind the scenes by doing, and that gives you the ability to get things done at the government level or get bills passed that help your friends who then donate back to your machine.
Yeah, it's a lot of power. And I want to make sure we touch on this before we let you go, Nancy. The Camden waterfront, symbolically and in real terms, what has it meant for Camden's narrative arc over the last, let's say, 30 years? Because this is a city that has hit some really rough times post-industrialization. I mean, what was the promise of the Camden waterfront, and how does it fit into the city's larger story?
Yeah, well, you get two very, very different answers to that question, depending on, of course, who you ask. George Norcross and a lot, and not just George Norcross, let's be clear, like a lot of business people and government leaders in Camden hail the tax breaks and the buildings that were built with those tax breaks on the Camden waterfront as a great, step towards bringing economic prosperity back to Camden. The waterfront was once a major driver of the Camden economy, and of course it, was no longer. And George Norcross says that everything he's done to try to help Camden. People who live in Camden, many of the community members, some of them activists, some of them just, folks who live in Camden. Your listeners know very well, it is a low-income city. It is a black and brown city. And I have spoken to numerous, numerous people who feel that those deals really robbed them of the ability to get, real community investment and projects that were going to provide jobs and projects that were going to provide benefits and amenities to residents in the city. The attorney general mentioned that in his press conference yesterday, that what this really comes back to are is the people of Camden and what that they were never truly served by the Camden real estate deals and tax breaks that happened there.
And I got to ask you this because George Norcross was sitting on the front row at the press conference announcing this indictment. So let's talk about the political ramifications. We only have about 90 seconds left, but the political ramifications of this indictment. You mentioned, his friend Steve Sweeney. He's backing him for governor. If you could just quickly summarize in about a minute what all of this will mean.
It's huge. I think, this is just such a shot across the bow of the political machines all over the state. We've had two massive things, really three massive things happen in the last 8 months or so. The indictment of Bob Menendez, our senator, and then the ensuing fight over his seat among Democrats that basically took down one of the machine's most potent tools, what's called the county line, a line on the ballot that signals to voters, these are the real Democrats, vote for them. They took that down, and that was one of the ways that machine bosses held power. And now you have a criminal indictment that really sends a signal to other political leaders that you cannot hide behind political campaign contributions and saying that this is all like politics as normal. That if George Norcross can go down for running a criminal enterprise, I think it really signals to many party bosses in the state that this stuff is just not going to be tolerated anymore.
And of course, we should note Norcross vociferously
Yes.
denied the allegations yesterday at his own press conference. He wasn't just sitting in the front row of
Yeah,
the
he
one
was
announcing
verbal.
the charges against him. I believe he called New Jersey's attorney general a coward. So plenty of fervor and spice in this particular showdown, and we'll see what happens. Nancy Solomon, WNYC senior reporter, thanks for joining us today on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me. That was fun.
A lot to talk about in New Jersey. And coming up, we have a lot to talk about on the debate around school vouchers has been a big issue in Pennsylvania, and now Jay-Z has weighed in, supporting the school choice campaign in the state. We want to hear from you. Email us, studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back. Lots to come.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Last year, Pennsylvania's school voucher debate was so intense, it caused a budget gridlock. And that was before Jay-Z got involved. Earlier this month, a company owned by the rap superstar announced it was throwing money and support behind the voucher idea here in Pennsylvania.
So what are vouchers? There are many versions, but in simple terms, it's when the government gives parents money to spend on educational expenses for their kids. That can include private school tuition.
Now, Pennsylvania does not have a pure voucher program yet, but a proposed law would create one called the Pennsylvania Award for Student Success, or PASS. These scholarships would go to low-income students who are zoned to attend low-performing schools. Elementary and middle school students would get $5,000 a year, high schoolers $10,000, and special education students $15,000.
Voucher supporters say these scholarships are lifelines for students stuck in struggling schools. Opponents say there's little evidence that they actually improve academic outcomes and that they take money from public schools. So we're going to talk about vouchers. And to do that, we have a couple of guests. We have Priyanka Reyes-Cora, a former middle school teacher who is now the K-12 Policy Director for Children First. Priyanka, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Guy Shiraki, a senior fellow for the Commonwealth Foundation. Guy, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
And we want to hear from you, of course, and we've already got a ton of comments. This is obviously a issue that inspires a lot of passion. Do you support vouchers? Do you have questions about them? Do you send your kid to private school? And if you don't support vouchers, is there another type of education reform that you would support? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-WHYY. You can also email us, studio2@whyy.org.
And Guy, we want to start with you. We know Jay-Z is putting weight behind this effort to drum up support for school vouchers, but I want to start with what we currently have in Pennsylvania. It's not a voucher system, tax credit system. Could you break down how it currently works?
Sure. Several years ago, about 25 years ago, there was a bipartisan effort in Harrisburg to create tax credits, which in its most simplest form allows businesses and individuals to donate money to scholarship organizations. And then low and working class families can apply for these scholarships or aid to go to any school they choose, which may be private or religious or non-public of any type. That's now existed for about 25 years and has been very successful. This year, we estimate that about 75,000 students will be using that as a way to have their parents or guardians pick a school for them. And we know it's successful because the parents apply. And in fact, almost as many parents have to be unfortunately turned down because the demand is overwhelming. So about 140,000 people apply and about 70,000 to 75,000 get scholarships. So it's very much, if you will, like a United Way idea that you donate to these scholarship organizations and then the money's available. It's been very, very successful. Parents apply, students are in a school they enjoy, and there's accountability because if the donors don't think it's working out, they don't donate. And if the parents don't think that it's working out, they remove their children. It's been a win-win and a good model.
So why then vouchers? Because this is a different type of model. It's aimed at doing a lot of the same things. So why would Pennsylvania also need a voucher program like this?
Sure, for two reasons. One is, as I had referenced, almost as many families are turned down because the money runs out. But secondly, it requires almost always some contribution from the families, and some families can't simply afford it. The lifeline scholarships or the PASS scholarships, as Governor Shapiro now calls them, would allow children with really almost in abject poverty or who otherwise come in a family situation where they don't have the resources. So I think the two primary reasons are, one, the demand for the tax credit program has been so overwhelming that the system, as successful as it's been for many, there's still some that are shut out. And second, some families, even with aid, aren't able to close the gap, and Lifeline or past scholarships would make sure the poorest kids. And frankly, I would hope that we could reach a point that this would become bipartisan or even nonpartisan. As Sherry explained it, these are for the poorest children attending the lowest performing schools, and I would hope there'd be, you know, bipartisan consensus to target those children and lift them up and give their parents choice.
Now, there is some bipartisan support. As you mentioned, Governor Josh Shapiro is supportive of this issue, although he did not back it strongly enough last year to get the proposal over the finish line. And there are some Democrats traditionally who have supported voucher-style programs. However, Priyanka, there are many lawmakers and constituents who are not in favor. Lay out the argument against vouchers.
Sure. Well, first and foremost, many of us school funding advocates and public school advocates believe that this is a crucial moment for us to all be focused on funding our public schools. And so that's where we want to devote all of our attention. We're in a year where just last year, the Commonwealth Court Judge Renee Jubilierer put out a decision that said our whole state's school funding system is unconstitutional. And we need to remedy that this year through a major statewide change to our school funding system. And that's where we need to keep all of the focus. Our system's unconstitutional. It's unfair because it discriminates against students who live in low-wealth areas. And so any program that is not contributing to public school funding is just a distraction that takes away focus and funding from the public schools that the state is tasked with funding.
I want to read a comment that we got on our IG Live from No Gun Zone, who comments, "I'm all for vouchers. Nothing changes without change." And I want to follow up to you, Priyanka, because we all know that, you know, the schools have been chronically underfunded. The court has held that the funding system was not fair. I want you to talk to like a parent of a sixth grader, right, who needs a short term, immediate, you know, solution to their kid going to a low-income school that's underperforming. What do you say to them if they believe that vouchers would be helpful?
Sure. I would say, and at Children First, we do work with many parents, many students who are attending schools that are underfunded. And I would say to all of them, this is the year to get involved in advocating for what you want the schools to look like. We have the most momentum that we've ever had, the most potential to get our schools fairly, constitutionally funded. And that if we get the full amount that we need this year as year one of a 7-year plan, we will see immediate changes. Schools will be able to afford the staffing that they have been missing out on for so long. They'll be able to make changes to their curriculum. They'll be able to improve school facilities. And yes, these aren't silver bullets. These changes do take time. But the potential that is there for those parents and for those students is something that we need them to be part of, because that's the sustainable solution for public schools.
I want to read a comment now from Douglas, who says the purported benefit of vouchers is that they will cause schools to respond to market competition. However, there's no evidence that this is the case, and vouchers clearly are being pushed as a way to undermine and defund public education. Guy Shiraki, senior fellow for the Commonwealth Foundation. I mean, you can look at the evidence around vouchers, whether they really do raise academic outcomes. I would say the most charitable summary is that it's mixed at best, and in some states it does seem to have a negative impact on academic outcomes. What's your response to that? Because I think a lot of people look at this policy and see it as wasted money.
So every time a child goes from a school that isn't working for her into a school that works, it's life-changing. And whether you live in Erie or South Philly, whether you have children in school or not, it's in everybody's interest that a child get into a situation where that child thrives and the parents are happy. A voucher program has absolute accountability in the sense that the parent is in charge. If the parent is dissatisfied with the child's academic performance or the way he or she is being treated or valued, they have the ability to move. right now, I mean, to the question that was asked earlier, Sherry, is what do you say to somebody who's the mom of a 9-year-old? And assuming that Priyanka gets everything she wants, that every single penny is allocated, it could take 2, 3, 5, 10 years to turn some schools around. If you're the parent of a 9-year-old, you're rooting for the school to turn around, but you don't know that it's going to, and shouldn't you be given that option? So one, I think what happens in a voucher program and a scholarship program is you immediately impact the lives of the children who get to go somewhere
else. But why don't
else?
We see that showing up in the research? I understand that the parent's preference might be to send the kid to a private school, but there's been – this concept's not new. I mean, you know, there's a voucher program in Milwaukee going back to the 90s, I believe. Why doesn't it not seem to be moving the needle? And, you know, when we make public investments, the idea is that there's going to be a public benefit. I mean, why aren't we seeing more of a public benefit when we invest in these programs?
Well, I think you do see a public benefit. Florida has the most ambitious voucher program, which is essentially money following the children. And even U.S. News and World Report recognizes that not only do they have universal school choice, but public schools in Florida rate is number one in the nation. So there is an element of competition. But the reality is there are thousands of children, you know, under the PASS bill, which, you know, Senator Tony Williams from Philadelphia is the architect. There are 250,000 children who qualify under that program, who are the poorest kids in the worst schools. If 20, 30, 40, 50,000 of them get to go somewhere else, their lives change immediately. I mean, imagine being the mom or dad of somebody. You wake up your 9-year-old daughter and send them to a school where you know no one in her fourth grade is proficient in math and reading. And even if you believe the teachers and the principal are the hardest working people with the best of intentions, if it's going to take them years to turn things around, shouldn't you give that parent the option? So I would respectfully disagree and say it is life-altering for the children who get to go. And it also holds the schools accountable, because if there's a rush out of a certain school, then the eyes and attention can be on it. Last point on the funding. From where I come from, the Commonwealth Foundation, we're supportive of what Priyanka wants. Last year, there was the largest increase in public education ever, 1 year after the largest increase of public education ever. This year, Governor Shapiro wants an even larger increase in public education. We're on board for it. We're saying we can walk and chew gum. We can bring the necessary resources to public education, at the same time give parents the options to send their student to a different school if that's what they'd like to do. We can do both, and we should all be on board for all the above.
And I want to take a moment and bring some parents in to hear some parental perspectives. And we have two Philadelphia parents who have two different views on this debate. First up, we have Camilla Brewerton, who is pro-voucher, a mom. Camilla, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, it's Kima.
I apologize. Kima Brewerton. Kima, so tell us a little bit about your story and why you say vouchers or school choice is the way forward.
Sure. So we came from a charter school. My son did a K-8 all the way through. And so around a year and a half ago, I was looking for something when we got into the high school realm, something that would be more disciplined for him. The high schools in my area did not perform up to my liking. So at that point, I was looking for funding for a private school option, which led me to Sharon of PA Ed Choice and led me to Guy of Commonwealth Foundation. So what I think about it, it's I love when the someone's just said about the short-term remedies. I feel like when it comes to your child's education, you should be the biggest opportunist. You shouldn't feel bad if an opportunity presents itself for your child right now to take advantage of that. When it comes to feeling like, you know, it's not working, look at Milwaukee, or look at this, or look at that. I think that it's just that the scale isn't cast big enough, right? So if we cast that scale, big enough, we'll see that we'll have better statistics and what works and what doesn't. We live in America, right? Mm-hmm. We know that a monopoly over anything, it would lack innovation, it would lack change. So when the person said, you know, there's nothing changes without change, we need to shake things up here. We need to shake things up. I have a young black child, a male that I'm raising right now. So I'm going to be his biggest advocate. I'm going to be his biggest opportunist, and I'm going to go for I'm going to go where opportunity presents itself for my child to grow up and be a good member of the community.
And that was Kima Brewington, mm-hmm. who was a mom in favor of vouchers. I want to bring in a dissenting voice now. This is Samia Evans Bowling, who is a public school advocate, also has children in the public system. Thanks for joining us today on Studio 2.
Hello, hi, good afternoon, and thank you for having me. Thank you for having me to talk about this very hot-button issue.
And so explain to folks first your situation, where your kids are in the public system, and why you see vouchers as a potentially damaging policy.
Okay, well, where I am in the School District of Philadelphia, I can't say that enough, I'm a proud product of the Philadelphia public school system. And my children are, my oldest son graduated high school recently last year, June class of 2023. He went to a very good school in our city for both high school and elementary. I have two sons. My youngest son, same thing. They went to schools, public schools in the city of Philadelphia, had a very good experience, and he will be entering high school this fall. He just graduated last Friday, high honors. Very good education in a public school. We've had a very good experience. And I am against the vouchers because when I look at the vouchers, it's not equally spread out. Whereas though if we fully fund our public education, that has access to all children. I'm opposed, strongly opposed against the vouchers because when I look at it and I see that the qualifications for the voucher programs, that again limits access, if, and that's a big strong if my husband and I were to think about our youngest son going into an alternative high school, if we were offered a voucher, I would say that we are automatically disqualified. Our children have not or have never been for their high school or their middle school experience. They went through first through eighth through one at OEC and kindergarten through eight at OEC. And
that's Overbrook Education Center for folks who
Overbrook
don't know.
Overbrook Education Center, yes.
I'm just sorry, Samia, can you just maybe summarize a bit? What is your opposition to vouchers? Why don't you think it's a good solution?
Against the vouchers because they are not equally spread out, whereas though to qualify for the vouchers, I would have to be in an income bracket, lower poverty, mm-hmm. which my husband and my family, we don't qualify for. I do not fit the criteria where my children went to the lowest performing schools with the lowest performing test statewide. That did not fit my criteria. So again, vouchers are only to a targeted audience, whereas though if we fully fund public schools, that money is spread out across to all. Think about the thousands of parents that will be displaced if they were to, again, say, hey, I have a school choice and I'm going to go and I don't fit this criteria. And again, if the vouchers are only up for a few thousand dollars, who's going to cover the rest of the cost, out-of-pocket cost, if the voucher doesn't cover that?
Thank you so much. Yep. That was Samia Evans Bowling, who is a proud public school mom. And so, Priyanka, I want to bring you in back into the conversation because what Kevin says, if every child in a low-performing school got a voucher, then there would be no kids in the school. Or are we only giving vouchers to certain children? I want you to kind of talk about some of the reasons, other reasons why folks are against vouchers. And we heard Samia kind of like talk about it a little bit, but $75,000 for a family of four, that's one of the requirements.
Sure. Well, one of the other reasons why vouchers don't make sense as a public policy for the use of state funds is because they don't work. There's no evidence, and Avi started talking about this earlier, there's no evidence that they actually improve student outcomes that people think they're going to deliver on. And there's a huge body of research at this point showing that student outcomes for students who leave a public school to go to a private school through a voucher program, that their student outcomes decrease, especially in math. And we really need to be thinking about investing our taxpayer dollars in things that work, that have a body of evidence that works. We know what works in public schools. Our public schools, when they have the funding, they work for our students. Philadelphia and other underfunded school districts around the state will be able to increase outcomes. We know it from Pennsylvania history. In 2003 to 2010, we had major increases in school funding, and we saw a corresponding increase in student achievement. In Philadelphia alone, the number of students who became proficient in at least one tested subject, math or reading, in that time period increased by a number of 35,000 kids. Pennsylvania rose in competitiveness to among the top in the nation between 2003 to 10.
Let me just bring in a couple more listener comments. So Kevin from Hellertown is concerned about the separation of church and state because students could use these funds to attend religious schools. Kevin calls that a theocracy approach. Ruth says, you do not take into account when students attend these private schools, they are not always welcome, end up getting kicked out or just leave. That happened to one of my students. Fix the public schools, ditch the vouchers. They only seem to benefit the already better off families. What do you say to that, Guy Shiraki? That they're, you know, this isn't just the parents' choice. The schools get to choose too, and oftentimes they're not throwing their doors open to everybody.
So on the issue of separation in church and state, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled twice overwhelmingly that vouchers are legal and permissible. They exist in states. They've existed in the state of Maine since almost the formation of the state of Maine. So they're perfectly legal, and I just would ask everybody to use common sense. We have a voucher system for college. We have a voucher system for graduate school. You can use a fee alone or a Pell Grant and go to a seminary. We've been able to do that. It's eligible for preschool. It's eligible. The reality is that religious organizations and public organizations and private organizations offer services to Americans from cradle to grave. The only time we ever fight about it is from K to 12. No one seems troubled that you can take a Pell Grant and go to St. Charles Seminary or learn to become a rabbi. So the church-state issue is really not applicable, and it doesn't apply in our daily lives. It shouldn't be an impediment here. Look, in the other issues, there seems to be this idea that we shouldn't trust parents, that parents don't know what a good school is, that parents don't know what success is. And every time we look, data matters and results matter. Of course they do. But when a parent feels that a school isn't working and has the ability to switch them to another school, the parent then decides whether the child's progressing. Why don't we trust the parent
Let me push back on that with this. With other types of government programs, Medicare, Medicaid, for instance, we don't just say, well, if the patient wants a surgery or wants a type of treatment, we automatically greenlight it. We evaluate the efficacy of that policy because we're trying to create a public policy. I mean, I think a lot of people here in our comments just feel like vouchers have not been proven to work, even if there are a good number of parents who will accept them.
We've had an EITC program that has had bipartisan support in the business community and the academic community now for going on 25 years. There's obviously a high level of interest. There are 70,000 students that are getting a chance to go through school choice because of it. There are 60,000 on a waiting list who were turned down.
But to the efficacy point, I just want to push you on that because let me just say it here in Philadelphia. Sure. Over the last 25 years, huge explosion of school choice in many different forms, EITC, charter schools, private, parochial. And yet, the results would suggest that the rising tide has not dramatically lifted all boats. What's the argument that more choice is going to result in better academic achievement across the board?
We've also tried the other way. When I first became involved in this issue, Philadelphia was spending $7,800 a child. Today, they're spending $24,000 a child. If the legislature adds the money that Priyanka would like, that I'm not opposed to, that number is going to go over $24,000 to $25,000 a child. I would respectfully submit we've tried it the money way, and it hasn't worked.
Priyanka, can you?
So why can't we do both? Yeah. And that is give the funding and let parents have a choice. I just don't understand why we don't trust parents. And again, I'll go back to my college analogy. A young person graduating this year from a Philadelphia public school that goes off to St. Joe's and gets a Pell Grant and gets a fee alone, we don't check her academics and say, I wonder if St. Joe's is delivering.
Right.
Are we getting ROI?
Just Priyanka, because we're about to be out of time, Priyanka, your response to that. Basically, the idea is that, you know, we have tried the public school monopoly for decades, and it did not produce the results that we wanted.
First, I'd like to just correct some of the data that was just used, that we spend over $20,000 per student. We look at student spending inclusive of student need. And so we have to take account for the different needs that students have, whether they live in poverty, acute poverty, concentrated poverty. All of those things require more funding. And when you look at the amount we spend per weighted student, meaning including student need, We spend about $10,000 per student in Philadelphia and more than double that in Lower Merion. The disparities are out of control. This is the basis of the lawsuit.
Real quick, as we wrap up, on that point of we've tried it the old way.
We have also tried, we've tried public school choice, but all the public school choices are underfunded. And so until we fund them all, it's not even a real choice.
Okay. Well, that wraps it up. And thanks to everyone who participated. A ton of comments we couldn't get to, and we do apologize for that. It was just a very active conversation today. Thank you so much to Guy Shiraki, Senior Fellow for the Commonwealth Foundation, and Priyanka Reyes-Cora, former middle school teacher, now the K-12 Policy Director for Children First. Thanks to you both.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you so much.
And that wraps up today's show. Our show is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Diana Martinez engineered our show today from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.